DW Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
On this show, an international meeting in Stockholm looks at dealing with terror in urban areas, how to reduce insecurities and violence for poor city dwellers, why so many tenement buildings in Nairobi, Kenya collapse, and how educators in Chile hope to improve the nation's schools. Stay tuned. Welcome to World in Progress from me, Anke Rasper, in Bonn, Germany. Barcelona in Spain was recently hit by a terror attack, which killed 15 people. Barcelona is just the latest in a long list of European cities that have experienced such attacks in recent years. Other cities around the world, of course, have known terrorist attacks for much longer. As international experts gather at a conference in Stockholm to discuss the issue of security in cities, our DW reporter there, Andrea Rönsberg, had a personal interest in finding out what they had to say. She knows what it's like if a city is facing a terror attack.
Sirens, lots of them. Ambulances speeding past, with more following suit. A seemingly endless symphony of sirens. That's how I knew it had happened again, this time in Stockholm, on April 7th. The Swedish Prime Minister confirmed what we'd all suspected when the ambulances had come speeding past, and news emerged that a truck had driven down a busy pedestrian zone in downtown Stockholm, ending its deadly journey when crashing into a department store. A big vehicle used as a weapon again, just like in an attack in Berlin, Germany, just a few months earlier, and in Nice, France, in July 2016, and again, just a few weeks ago, in Barcelona, Spain. The simple fact is, says Dan Smith, director of the Stockholm Peace Research Institute, that no city is safe.
Neither in the region of the Middle East and North Africa, nor in Europe, can we really say it can't happen here, because the weapons to use are so simple to get hold of, and many of them are not at all complicated to use. Yes, making a bomb, that's very complicated, but using a van, a knife, even guns are relatively easy to get hold of. So I don't think that we can find that kind of safe location.
After terrorist attacks had hit the Belgian capital of Brussels on March 22, 2016, that is exactly what I tried to do, find a safe location. I lived in Brussels at the time, frequently worked at the DW bureau there. It's close to Malbec metro station, where one of the bombs went off that day, after another bomb had detonated at the airport. 35 people were killed that day. This one felt too close for comfort. But there seems to be only one way to escape the terrorist threat: move to a small town, or better yet, the countryside.
They tend to target large cities, and that's because that's where there are lots of people, sadly, where they can achieve their largest number of casualties. But also, of course, it makes a massive political impact, and it makes a massive impact through the media.
That's Bernard Hogan Howe, formerly commissioner of the Metropolitan Police in London. His tenure gets mixed reviews, but even critics heap praise on Hogan Howe for one achievement. During the 5 years he was in office, until resigning earlier this year, London was not hit by a terrorist attack, not one. He says that's because the police learned a few lessons early on from events like the 9/11 attacks on New York and Washington in 2001 and the July 7 attack in London in 2005.
I would say that the partnership between the police and the security service in the UK is the best in the world. I say that because after 9/11/77, we created a new structure where the police and the security service work alongside each other in the same buildings and day by day carry out operations. Since those units have been formed, we've got good personal relationships. And I do think that our community-based policing has remained a bedrock on which we can gather intelligence.
The police have to be present in the community, says Hogan Howe. People have to trust the police. Only then will inhabitants of any given neighborhood approach the police to inform them something may be afoot. But it's not just in terms of immediately preventing an imminent attack that the community level is key, says Dan Smith.
We need to be thinking about social circumstance and about education. We need to be thinking about how communities in different countries, whether it's in, you know, in Nigeria or in the Indian subcontinent or anywhere on the continent of Europe, how communities have both self-identity and legitimacy and pride in themselves without at the same time then finding a basis on which they feel humiliated and their dignity is taken away.
This kind of community work is a daily struggle in Swedish cities such as Stockholm, where I have found a new home. Small town life, secure though it may be, simply doesn't work for me in the long term. But living in a European capital again, and reading in the papers every day about violence in the suburbs, about knife attacks, open drug trade, about the police admitting it's struggling hard to get a grip, I do wonder how long this long-term approach will take before the root causes of terrorist attacks are eliminated. Yet, however long it takes, says Dan Smith, there is no alternative.
So I think if Islamic State is thoroughly defeated in Syria and in Iraq and also in North Africa and elsewhere where it has managed to put down roots or make connections, then while defeated there, it will, its members, its activists will disperse, they will join with other groups. IS grew out of Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda grew out of what came before. If we simply focus on the terrorist group, then maybe that group will be finished for now, but similar people will be forming other groups which will later on hit us as well.
As I walk through the pedestrian zone in central Stockholm on a sunny Friday afternoon to the day 5 months since the terror attack, I'm not quite sure of what to feel. A sense of security? After all, I've been told about how terrorist attacks on cities have become the new normal, how it can happen anywhere, anytime. No, maybe not. But neither do I feel anxious. There are no flowers, pictures, or harrowing memories left at Drottninggatan, where the attack took place. Only a small white sign saying that a wall of remembrance has been put up at another site. A woman stops to look at the sign.
Ja, det känns ju märkligt. Man tänker på.
It does feel a bit strange to think about what happened here, she says. But at the same time, we can't all be scared all the time it might happen again. We can only remember, she says. Remember, I think, and carry on. Andrea Rönsberg, DW, Stockholm.
And it's not just terrorism that's a security concern in cities. There are many other challenges for city dwellers, particularly for poor people. Urban areas in many parts of Asia and Africa are growing at a very fast pace and changing societies. That brings many opportunities, but poses new insecurities and different forms of violence. I talked to Dr. Amira Sawas, who's a researcher with the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI. I first asked her if people's concept of security in the cities of developing countries differs to those in developed countries.
Well, people in cities in the global south, they deal with precarity every day. There are many stresses and insecurities of daily life. What is very interesting, though, is how in the research that I've been doing over the last 7 years, that people conceptualize different forms of violence in really interesting ways. So we did research with 2,500 people across two cities in Pakistan, and many spoke about what they called zehni tashaddud. This is an Urdu phrase which literally translates into psychological violence or mental torture. What they mean by that, dealing with livelihood insecurity, struggling to find access to clean water supply every day, population growth, the commute to work is incredibly stressful. Basically, this is what they call a form of sort of mental torture. But obviously, you know, they describe different forms of physical violence which they face as well. So security is a much more broad term.
You mentioned violence in cities, and that appears to be higher than in rural areas. Why is that?
Well, in rural areas, you tend to have groups of families or traditional structures which have social cohesion. Whereas in cities, you have very, you know, cities that are urbanizing very fast, and you have lots of people moving from the rural areas into the cities. So there are lots of new people living side by side. There is a kind of challenging of traditional social norms. So, you know, women are contesting traditional ideas about what their life should look like. So this is causing at times a backlash. But also, we have actually found in our research that groups of young men have committed violence in the street against women that they perceive have done something which is not seen as moral or appropriate for women.
So the people who experience this violence, is that mostly women?
No, all genders experience different forms of violence within cities in the global south. What's interesting, in Africa, you tend to have much more female mobility compared to Asia. So, for example, 70% of the informal market vendors in Zimbabwe are women. They will obviously experience more sexual harassment and more public violence because they're more in the public sphere. Whereas in South Asia, it's a bit less visible. But also in South Asia, men are very much prone to experiencing violence. And this is all sorts of violence, from sexual violence to, you know, firing, gunfire. Men find it harder to talk about their experience.
Now, if the city government or public entities cannot provide access to drinking water, garbage collection, sanitation and so on, how can the fact that informal actors that sometimes move in, how can those groups lead to an increase in violence and stress?
Well, sometimes these groups play a very important role in ensuring people's basic services. But what we do find is that it's seen as a kind of opportunity to make money. So the kind of groups that tend to step in tend to be groups of informal networks of men. So they govern them in fairly coercive and sometimes violent ways, and they expect to be paid very extortionate prices. But then there's also a reaction. So particularly men who feel frustrated because, you know, these extortionate costs of basic services. So they then sometimes lash out. But then this is also displaced onto women within the home who are not able to do their household duties with the very small amount of, let's say, water that they actually have. So often they become victims of domestic violence.
These informal actors, are they all kind of semi-criminal, or are there also any positive examples?
There are many positive examples. In Karachi, there's a very famous example called the Arangi Pilot Project, which is basically a sanitation system that was set up by the community in the 1980s because they sort of had enough that there was no sanitation system. And eventually this became more formal and they worked with government. And now there are over 250 replications of this project all over the world, including in Africa. And there are some other really great examples in Africa, actually. In a township near Cape Town, violence prevention through urban upgrading. And there's a really great example on Nairobi, on the Kibera informal settlement. So they focused on transforming unsafe areas into spaces of beauty, but also social cohesion around basic services.
Is it economic development that is needed most to counter these high levels of violence?
There was an expectation that the economic benefits of growth at a national scale will have trickle-down effects for the poorest and for those who experience the violence the most, but that's not actually happening. So what we need is something which is a much more grounded perspective. And I think that the vision of development needs to be created in consultation with local people. We just have to try and focus more on listening to the voices of the people at the ground level and creating positive interfaces for them with each other so that the city doesn't become an area of competition, it becomes an area of cooperation.
That was Amira Sawas, a researcher from the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, SIPRI. Our next story is also about the risk faced by city dwellers, but in this case, it's unsound buildings. Many poor people in Nairobi, Kenya, live in apartment buildings that are unsafe. Warning signals like cracks in the walls are often overlooked or played down by the landlords. But a number of tenement buildings have collapsed over the past few months, and several dozen people have been killed because they were not able to leave their homes in time. Linda Staude reports from the Kenyan capital. Her report is presented by Neil King.
A group of people watch helplessly as black sand trickles from a hole in the wall of their tenement house. Wooden supports snap and glass panes shatter. A short time later, the five-story building collapses. Only a pile of rubble remains of what used to be a home. The caterpillar starts clearing the rubble. At least the former tenants had time to save themselves and some belongings before the building collapsed. In April 2016, people living in a building in another part of Nairobi weren't so lucky.
I was sitting at home and my child was already asleep. Suddenly the building collapsed and I called to God, "Why must I die with my family?" I was able to clear the stones from myself and my wife. But when I went to free my child, it was too late. She was dead.
Kevin and his wife survived with injuries. Their child and 50 of their neighbours died. The seven-storey apartment block had been built illegally. It was much too close to the bank of a small river. Just like a whole series of residential blocks in the Huruma neighbourhood in Nairobi's northeast.
I would like to ask the government, didn't you foresee anything wrong when these houses were built? Or do you just want us to suffer?
Residents here are bitter. The homes had been slated for demolition. But before people had a chance to move out and the excavators could move in, severe rainstorms caused flooding, leading to the collapse of the dilapidated structure. Ayan Shankla is a structural engineer.
You can generally, you know, people who are living in the building, you will be able to see that, you know, your cracks are gradually opening. You don't get a sudden collapse of a building, especially concrete.
But Shankla says such warning signals are often overlooked in Nairobi's poor districts. Dorothy Ihoyo used to live in a tenement house in Embakasi until it collapsed earlier this year.
I saw the cracks and asked the caretaker what was going on. The owner then sent a couple of people to make simple repairs on the ground floor and dismissed it as normal maintenance work.
Thanks to a hectic last-minute emergency evacuation, most tenants were able to escape, but two people lost their lives in the ruins. Cheap housing is life-threatening in Nairobi. According to Kenyan media reports, 30,000 buildings in the city are on the demolition list.
When you are going to bring down a building which has a title deed, they quickly run to court and they stop you. That's one. Number two is corruption.
Evans Kidoro is the head of the municipality of Nairobi and also oversees the Regional Construction Administration. But so far, the construction authorities have refused to comment on the issue. It's simply too controversial. And citizens like Randy Mwenye are angry.
We have a shortage of housing units in Nairobi. And so people are taking advantage of making things which are cheaply made, and we are risking our lives. I think the local government should be taken to task because somebody is sleeping on their job.
But even if dilapidated buildings are dismantled before they collapse, that's the worst solution for everyone involved, says Ayan Shankla. And that also goes for the landlords responsible for erecting the dangerous structure.
There is no malice, there is no criminal intent. If you look at the person whose building has fallen down, when something like this collapses, he is in a terrible situation.
The city of Nairobi also loses out. Taxpayers pay more than 1.2 million euros for the demolition of 30,000 buildings. But things are worst for the tenants, such as the former inhabitants of the houses that used to stand on the river Huruma.
Many people here are street hawkers. They cannot afford anything else. Others are day labourers. They don't know whether they'll find a job tomorrow. Where should people like us move to?
It's of little use for the poor tenants if the architects, construction companies or engineers responsible for the construction are taken to court after a building has collapsed. But Michael Okonji from the Engineers Organization promises that those responsible will face consequences.
It is our member who we licensed and who failed to carry out diligent professional duties. We go ahead, we deny them the licenses, we take disciplinary action.
Of course, it's much better to prevent catastrophes in the first place by constructing houses safely. This needs improved cooperation between different building authorities, a more effective construction supervision, and timely inspections. Also, developers and landlords planning to erect buildings need to get more information so they don't save money in the wrong places, says engineer Ayan Shankla. And the structural parts of the building that make sure a building remains upright should always be solid.
Cost of building a bad job and a good job, the percentage is very little, maybe 10-15%. He's not making a lot of saving in an element which should be done properly, built properly. And then you start now saying, okay, I'm going to reduce by having maybe a, you know, expensive door, maybe buy cheaper doors. The building wouldn't come down.
Erecting safe buildings will save everyone money in the end. But until this dawns on those responsible for the constructions, the inhabitants of dilapidated tenements can only hope they will make it out of their buildings alive. That further buildings will collapse is pretty certain. It's just a matter of time.
That was Neil King presenting a story by Linda Staude from Nairobi, Kenya. Our last story today takes us to South America. It's election year in Chile, and one of the big political issues is education. Students and teachers have been protesting about the system for more than 10 years, demanding better pay for teachers and modern curricula. But one group of people has decided the best way to improve the system is through change in schools, rather than protests on the streets. We sent our reporter Jane Chambers to meet them.
Protesters meet here in the centre of Santiago at Plaza Italia and shout slogans as they make their way down to the government building La Moneda. Today there are around 500 people. There were massive protests here in 2006 and 2011 when thousands of students took to the streets demanding change. This led to some government reforms, but teachers and students don't think they've gone far enough.
We are fed up that here in Chile, education is treated like a business. The teachers are treated really badly. They are sacked if they are off sick for too long. They should be paid much better than they are. Their wages are terrible.
Teachers in Chilean state schools earn less than cleaners. They say that they have far too much paperwork and the exams and school books are outdated. That's why they're protesting. But Chilean educator Tomás Ricart is part of a group of people who don't think that protests are the only way to make change happen. Inspired by the protests in 2006, he founded Enseña Chile in 2009. Enseña Chile means teach Chile, and it's a charity that believes people are the key to change. It recruits college students to give up 2 years of their life and teach on a minimum wage in vulnerable areas of Chile.
The protest of 2006 was very important for us because we realized that although all the political parties agreed on a law, if you are standing in the low-income communities of the schools of our nation, nothing changes really. So public policy is very important, but not sufficient. So we ask ourselves, what triggers all the solutions that need to be done? And we ended up knowing what Teach for America was doing in the United States and Teach First in England. And we said, it's people. People at the end are what triggers the changes. Therefore, what we do, prominent future leaders teach in low-income communities for at least 2 years. And then from that experience, they are the agents of change.
How can the people who go into your schools help? What kind of things are they doing that makes a difference?
I would say the most important is high expectations. Kids say, if you don't care, we don't care. But if we care, they also care. And that's I would say, the main thing.
Just like Teach for America and Teach First, Enseña Chile is a highly competitive program to get on, and future employers think it creates future leaders. Juan Paulo Sanchez thought he had his life mapped out. He went to a private school in Chile and then a good university where he studied civil engineering. He decided to apply for Enseña Chile because he thought it would look good on his CV. But after 2 years, the experience he had with the children changed his life. And instead of going into the corporate world, he and a group of fellow Enseña Chile colleagues raised money to set up their own primary school, Crey Naví in Santiago. When I went to see him at the school, he started off by telling me about the community he decided to help.
So Cerro Navia, where we are, is a very poor community, one of the communities with the lowest results in education in Chile. And in particular, this part of Cerro Navia is the neighborhood that has the biggest challenge on delinquents, problem with drugs, with people, parents of students that are at jail. Like, what they are going through is very, very hard. And if we are able to show here that all the students are able to achieve the same results that best private schools, we will be able to be part of the conversation where the decisions are made for the future of our students.
So why is this school different to other schools? What do you do here to try and make changes?
All the teachers and all the people that were here is committed to do whatever it takes to show that our students have the same potential that the students in high-income schools. And this means that they work more, this means that they don't give up. So I have seen a lot of changes from students that were in second grade that arrived here and they had no idea how to read and how to write. And right now we saw the results in assessment and they are performing very good, like better than a lot of schools, and their normal track would have been like. Now they are on track and learning what they need to go to university. On the other hand, I have seen students that struggle a lot with behavior. That when they arrived to school, they weren't able to stay inside the classroom and follow teacher instructions. And now I see those same students like winning the Student of the Week prize or being models of how a student should behave in a classroom, helping the teachers.
All morning, the children have been coming up and asking me questions. But 9-year-old Unis, who's one of the star students, has been picked to talk to me. She's wearing her school uniform with pride, a blue tracksuit top with the name of the school on it and a black shirt with some black trousers. She has 32 classmates who are watching her out of the classroom window, while next door the younger ones are practising dancing for the Chilean National Day, which is coming up soon. Unis loves to read in the library, and I want to know what she's been studying this morning. So, what have you been learning this morning?
Hacemos juego.
We play games and they teach us techniques to solve problems. It is much better than my last school, which was boring, and the teacher would stand at the front of the class and we would write down what she said. Here, learning is a lot more fun.
And what about your future? What do you want to do in the future?
I want to be a teacher and a journalist.
Working hard in the school reception, I have got Maria Ignacia, who is one of the mothers here, and I just want to know what she thinks about the school.
As parents, we think this school gives new opportunities to our children. So it's a great project. Other schools around here always have problems. The teachers are on strike, or the students are on strike protesting about the reforms. There are up to 40 children in a classroom, and they're very small and badly lit, without many resources. Whereas here, we have 27 children to a classroom, and the conditions are much better.
And what difference have you noticed with your daughter after coming here?
The teachers have tough expectations, which help her in all aspects of life, both in her studies and the way she behaves at home. It's funny, because when I do something that doesn't reflect the values she learns here at school, she says, "Mommy, you need to try harder and not give up."
Schools like this one and the teachers at Enseña Chile are making a big difference to low-income families in Chile, giving them hope for a better future. But Tomás, Juan Paulo, and many other educators in the country say it's not enough to launch projects and that the whole education system has to improve. They think the government needs to realise that teachers are the solution. The teaching quality will improve if teachers get better pay. That way, the good ones won't move to the private sector. And the head teachers need more room to make decisions. For now, the protests for improving the national education system continue. At the same time, Tomás and Juan Paulo are carrying on with their direct action, pushing for change by helping to make it happen. Jane Chambers, DW, Santiago, Chile.
And that wraps up today's edition of World in Progress. Thanks for your interest. You can listen back to these reports and past editions of World in Progress. Just go to dw.com/worldinprogress or download the podcast from iTunes or SoundCloud. You can also find more globalization stories on Facebook. Just go to DW Global Society. Make sure to tune in next week for a special on democracy. Until then, we, the studio team here in Bonn, Germany, that's Iliane Giarducci, Jürgen Kuhn and me, Anke Rasper, say goodbye and take care.